This is a digital recording of the Academic Senate meeting of April 30th, 2015.
Yes. So, live? Yes, we're live. Okay. It is just serendipity that something fell from heaven. This was not planned for today, but, oh well, it'll help.
Sure.
As I said, we have no, it's a mistake. It landed here.
Right.
This is serendipity, and probably it'll be a good thing. All right, so as I open, you'll see that we do have a packed agenda with some important things, and we really want to make sure that all the input that should be brought into it gets a chance to happen, and that all the items, especially because we only have one more Senate session here, and we have a couple of first reading items, so we really do need to get to those things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be privileging Senate business over reports. And as the first modeling of that behavior, I'll be sending some information out on the Senate members list, communications that I've gotten from my colleagues and whatnot, and so you should be seeing that. And I'm hoping that in the cases of the standing committees that would be giving reports, that they could do the same. So we will enforce Robert's rules and the bylaws because they were developed specifically for when we have packed agendas and especially when people want to get to weigh in on those. And so I will do my best to hold to time certain, including if at the time that a time certain arrives, I'll probably be interrupting and asking that we make some kind of motion or decision, even if we have a speaker partway through. And then if we do have to extend anything, the extensions are going to be moved to the end of the last business item so that extensions of discussions will, if needed, will end up being in any extended meeting time that we also agree to do. All right. So with that said, are there any committees that have a particularly pressing item that couldn't be sent out on a report and needs to be reported on and therefore needs a time certain? Okay, I don't see any of those. Or any other amendments requested on the agenda? Okay, thank you. So let's move to the minutes, which were emailed out. And I don't know how closely you were reading them. Anybody have any suggestions of corrections, amendments, redactions? Would anybody object to us redacting Armand's funny about whether we should be calling EPC the Extinguished Programs Committee? He did say that. He wanted on the record. All right, then we can let them go. That'll be a little cupcake for somebody who's doing historical archive work in the future. All right, we have as a proxy for AS. Chief of Staff Courtney Parker, Brandon Mercer will be here. Courtney Parker is here for Brandon Mercer, and Neil Markley is here for CFO Brooke Arslan. We also welcome Gary, what's the last name?
Pratt,
who is is Ruben's shadow today. So he's visiting from Washington, and I got a great lunch with him today, and that was good to swap notes across state institutions. All right, so you see all the time certains stated on there. We have a consent item, the early childhood education certificate, and the proposal was emailed. And is there any wish to discuss that, or should we pass that as a consent? Any objections to it going as a consent? Okay, then we have the certificate program in early childhood education. So that's good news. All right, well, let's see. Okay, so given that, President Armignano, do you have anything to report? We have just a few minutes before our first concert. Nothing to report? Any questions for the President? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Armignano, I was visited by a colleague in another department in the School of Social Sciences. And my understanding is that a complaint had been received by from a student anonymously about an image that was used in a flyer advertising an event that was affiliated with the department and a club associated with the department. And the complaint requested an apology based on what turned out to be an inaccurate interpretation of the image. And my question is, if there is one, what is the administration's policy about in terms of responding to complaints like that? And do those responses include some reference or defense of academic freedom? I know you have a history on this campus of having defended academic freedom. And I was hoping to hear that when you do respond to complaints like that, you point out that academic freedom is a fundamental part of the university and all those things that we all say when we talk about it.
First, I have no knowledge of the specifics of what you're talking about. Never heard of it, never seen it. You know, that's the first time I hear of it. Or I cannot speak to the details of it, but people are not going to get a response of being sorry for something that not need to be sorry about. There is a distinction between offensive material, which is legitimately offensive, and for that it should not happen, I should not be accountable for, versus regular stuff that I might not agree with, but it's not offensive, and it will be an infringement upon the academic freedom, not just of the faculty, but others at the university. But I think you have to take every case on its own merit, and on this one I have no knowledge of.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the president? Okay, seeing none, let us move to, we have just a few minutes for the report from Provost Rogerson. Anything to report?
Just a few highlights. I think we're becoming very popular as a campus, which is good news. For the fall of 15, we set an all-time record in the number of first-time freshman applications of 15,249. That's up 6% from last year and up 36% from 09. Pretty impressive. We're also doing well with our freshman retention rate. It's at a healthy 81%. And the latest numbers on how many of our undergraduates are registered full-time, we're up to 92%. So we only have 8% part-time students on this campus at the moment. The popularity is reflected in our current admission numbers. As of this morning, we have 1,745 first-time freshmen depositing. To give you a perspective, last year at the same time we had 1,577. So we are actually seeing a lot of interest from the first-time freshmen. We are holding to an eligibility index of 3,200, so these are all good students that want to come. I confess it's a little bit scary because we are still open until the end of tomorrow, and historically quite a few hundred students sign up at the very last minute. So we're on track to have a fairly healthy first-time freshman camp. To counter that, housing is almost full, so quite a lot of those students might actually decide not to come. And of course, the other unknown is whether the UCs open up, because I'm sure some of this reflects the UCs being closed. When they open up, perhaps some of our students will melt away. But at the moment, we're heading to have a very high first-time freshman count. Transfers are also kind of high. 890 have deposited, 763 last year. So it's good. So no mistake, it's a popular campus.
So we have a minute before our next time, our first time certain, Senator Roberts.
Thank you, Provost Rogerson. Just a quick question. Do you think that we'll be able to have a freshman experience for all our freshmen who are coming in of some sort?
I hope so. We're meeting on Monday to have a kind of tactics talk, but the intention is yes. But again, this number probably will melt down somewhat. But it is high, and we should feel good about it.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
There are also 30 out-of-state students. That may not sound like a lot, but that's up a lot from last year. We're really starting to ramp up the out-of-state students. That's 30 to positive.
We have just a little bit of time, Senator Watt.
Very quick question. I'm wondering, in recent years, we've had additional GE sections being added over summer or even as early as now. Are you anticipating any of those coming along?
Yeah, I believe we opened up some today and looking, John, not yet. Yeah, we opened quite a few hundred seats today. And we'll keep doing that.
Okay, then, we are at our time certain, and so I would like to invite Professor Jaffe to come up for the Human Development Revision. I'd like to remind everyone this is a first reading, so what we're trying to do is make sure that we have all the information that we're going to need in order to make the decision at the second reading. It's a curriculum revision proposal, and so it will be introduced by Senator Milligan and our guest, Dr. Jaffe. And so, again, I will also try to, we are going to, remember, we're going to try and keep things moving this time. So, Senator Milligan?
Thank you. Thank you very much. So I should note that Professor Jaffe is the interim coordinator for the Human Development Program. And so she's bringing forward this revision to the Human Development Program. Just as background, you may recall that earlier this academic year, we had as a consent item on our agenda a revision of the Human Development Program that was for next year's catalog, for the 15-16 catalog. And the revision that's in your packet now is a proposed revision for the 16-17 catalog. And so that's why you're seeing multiple revisions in the same year. And to give you a little bit of additional context, human development is housed in the School of Social Sciences, but at present it is not affiliated with a department. Earlier this year, well, actually in conjunction with the current proposal, EPC also weighed in on a proposal for reorganization that would move the human development major under the purview of anthropology, not part of anthropology, but linked to it, which in the past was sort of an issue because human development not being linked to a department sort of fell through the cracks in terms of basic maintenance. In that reorganization proposal, EPC was asked in that proposal, EPC's job in a reorganization proposal is to weigh in, to comment on whether there are any curricular changes that the reorganization proposal will cause. And EPC's response was yes. In fact, the curricular changes are the ones that are proposed, that are being brought concurrent with the reorganization proposal. That reorganization proposal doesn't come to Senate. It just stops at EPC for comment on its way through a more administrative chain. But part of that reorganization proposal that you might find interesting or relevant here is that anthropology has established an MOU that's part of that proposal, an MOU with the administration that notes that they will take human development contingent on human development being given a higher next year. Not anthropology being given a higher, but human development being given a higher. And I only mention that as background because so that you can understand why you have in front of you a pretty straightforward proposal to revise the human development major. And so the proposal that Professor Jaffe has submitted was for 16-17 was unanimously approved at all levels of review. And we have it in your packet before you for your consideration. And one of the things that we can talk with Professor Jaffe about is any questions you might have about the specifics of the proposal. I also actually should note that I don't think the full-length proposal went out to the Senate electronically, which is what we expected, and it fell through the cracks in the hubbub of this week. But in your packet, you have the substantive portion of the proposal. There's approximately another 50 pages of emails that indicate all of the agreements negotiated with the departments whose courses are linked to human development. And so we can get that out to you for a second reading if you're so interested. So, Karen, would you like to tell us a little bit?
Can I interrupt for just
a moment? Absolutely.
It was consent all the way up until executive committee. Do you want to?
Yes, exactly. And so at executive committee, there was a concern that because of the complexity of the program revision being linked to a hire, even though that's not what's on your agenda today to decide on, that it would be something that would be useful to bring to the Senate as a whole for awareness purposes. So, Karen, would you like to just briefly give us an introduction about the changes that you're proposing for the major? I should note that, again, remember this is a first reading, so we should be looking for any questions that we might have that we could answer in a second reading for you.
Okay, so I realize that you're not seeing a color copy. So the first page, so really my side-by-side is just the first five pages. The first page is the prerequisites. The changes are really on some level clarification that the GTA requirement is overall, not Sonoma. And then requiring a C or better in all of the prerequisite courses. The reason for this is just to make sure that the transfer prerequisites and the matriculated student prerequisites are the same. They are not currently the same. I'm trying to align them. It ends up being a problem for undeclared advising when you've got, they've got two sets of students with two different prerequisites. The rest of the major, I tried to do a side-by-side comparison, but it's a complete overhaul, so it's a little bit difficult. Currently, the core requirements, the 23 to 25 units that you'll see on your left-hand side, only three of those core units are human development courses. Everything else in the major, all 40 units in the major except for those three, are outside of human development, which means students can take, can basically take 92% of the major in an impacted major without being declared. So a big reason why I did this revision was to make 20 of the 40 units be human development courses that are only open to human development majors. So that's what you'll see first in the core. The core, the only class that is not a human development class is anthropology/HD318. I take everything else out of the major and either remove it if departments request it, and that's noted in the rationale, or move it to different areas in the major. So what gets replaced with those courses is senior seminar stays, but then we're going to implement new courses. HD 450 is going to be a methods course for human development majors, and then 12 units of what I'm calling HD 350, topics in human development, which will be topical courses. Designed to be topics courses so that we can decide what those actual courses will be in fall 2016 or 2017 when the new hire comes through, not at this point in time. I've included an appendix at the end of this bigger rationale that indicates some potential courses that could be taught as topics courses, and these are just kind of off the top of my head, talking with other people, not being kind of a human development person myself, but just to give you an idea that there are topical courses out there. Then the area, the major perspectives switch from kind of being perspectives that were departmental, so a psychological perspective or a sociological perspective. The problem with those perspectives is they were very heavy in certain departments, and when departments that were impacted pulled their courses, there were now no courses in those areas. So what I tried to do was make areas, breadth of topical areas that were a little, that seemed to me to be a little bit more reasonable for a human development major, not based on, you know, kind of departmental areas, but more on phase of life cycle. So you'll see I've switched the methodology perspective with a topical area called childhood and adolescence. You'll see the courses that have been included. There are many education courses that would be included in that area, as well as a topics course in human development if we needed to offer one. The second topical area would be adults and lifespan. So we have a topic that would be kind of, you know, young children and then adults in the complete lifespan. And you'll see in that some of the courses have been removed or moved, and I've gotten permission to add some new courses. So Biology 318, the GE course of Biology of Aging, was never included in the major until, if this gets approved, fall of 2016. And you'll see a variety of courses. The benefit, I got approval from all these departments. The benefit for departments like kinesiology is KIN 410 is currently a required course, and it's the only course that meets a requirement, and it's very hard for them to accommodate human development students. Now every single course that is not a human development course is an elective. And there are GE courses in every single area, so there should not be any problem with human development students getting courses for the major. The third topical area is, goes from psychological perspective to gender and sexuality, and you'll see I've gotten permission to add to the current list nursing 480, which has never been in the major before, and also WGS 325. And then again, move some courses to other areas. And then finally, I changed comparative perspective to society, culture, and language, and didn't really add any new courses to that, but moved some courses from other perspectives into that perspective and then removed some courses to other areas. And then the elective, that doesn't get students to 40 units, so they would still need to take another course or two, and that would be any courses from the list that they haven't taken, plus some methods courses that used to be offered in the methods perspective or internships or special studies. Sorry, that was quick, but
thank you.
And it's designed to give flexibility to the major to ensure that it's an accurate list. Right now, we have courses that students think they can take that they are not allowed to take because they're closed to different majors. So I worked really hard to make sure that these are actually courses that are going to be available to human development majors and to make it make more sense, I think.
Okay, so we have a speakers list of three on it already. If you want to get on it, just make it clear that you're trying to get on, especially if we have any guests, if they could stand and signal them, we'll let you know if we get you on. So let's start with Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank UPC Chair Milligan for her masterful introduction of what is a very complex situation, and Professor Enstrom for her incredible work on bringing into shape a major that had so much pulled away from it and bringing it some integrity and cohesiveness. There are two other pieces of information, background information, that I think it's important for the Senate to have. One is that when the fate of the human development major was originally brought to the School of Social Sciences Curriculum Committee, which is the same as the department chairs, one and the same in our school. The Social Sciences Curriculum Committee agreed to, quote, suspend, unquote, this program, or recommended that it be suspended because there was, at that time, not a department that was willing to take it on. The decision to move forward was made administratively as opposed to on the original recommendation of the faculty. Secondly, the hire associated with this, my understanding is one of the six that's available for next year. So rather than actually six being available or up for grabs, there are five and possibly fewer if the other information is correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Senator Rang?
Yes, my question is similar. It's not in this packet, but it was mentioned by the EPC chair at the beginning, so it's the opinion of the parliamentarian of the Senate that this question is appropriate. the EPC chair stated that the guaranteed hire would not be in anthropology, but it seems to me that since the human development major will now be housed in anthropology, that hire would be a member of the anthropology department and would go through RTP through the anthropology department, and the anthropology department would be on the RTP committee. So I don't understand how the hire is not in anthropology.
I think the clarification is because when the dean of the School of Social Sciences was looking for what to do with human development, there were other departments, I believe, that considered taking on human development and taking the hire. And so the understanding has been that the hire goes with whoever's willing to take on human development, and it's 140 majors. And so I think that's been something that it's been important for anthropologies, from their perspective, to emphasize that it's an HD hire, not an anthropology hire. But I believe your explanation of how the tenure and review process would work is accurate. I can't recall if the memo is that detailed or not, but I imagine that what you said makes sense. But again, we can provide the memo for the second reading, if you'd like.
Okay, Senator Roberts.
Thank you very much. I also echo Senator Nelson's accolades for all the work. One of the things that I think might make a stronger case, and be advised, I sent a lot of nursing folks to this major, is you talk about that before 92% of the major could be completed without being declared and how many units are outside the major. I think it might strengthen if you talk about the position itself, how many units the new hire would teach, and maybe some other responsibilities. It's in here, I apologize. But in any case, that's just my suggestion.
Okay. No, let's not respond to yet. I wanted to get Senator Laney in, and then, because we are getting to the end of time. So, Senator Laney?
I just had a quick question. Yep. Is there any limit to the double counting with GE?
Do you want me to answer that? No.
What was the question?
Is there any limit to double counting the GE?
Do you want me to answer
that? Yeah, that's a quick one.
Yeah, no. There is not.
Okay. And then, Senator Ortiz, you were on?
Actually, that's exactly what I was going to say, because it's almost 20 units that could be double counted as GE, so that would leave a lot.
So then, I guess we have just a smidgen of time. So did we want to put the question, or did you want any feedback, or are you just wanting that for next week?
Just suggestion.
A suggestion for information by next week. Okay. Are there any other questions or comments? Are there more materials that you feel would need to have added? You can let either Senator Milligan or Dr. Karen Jaffe know, and so we can make sure that we have all that information for you. Next week when we actually take action on it. All right. So, thank you. So, thank you, Karen. All right, so we move to our next time certain, and we're actually on time. We now move to the Direct Entry Masters of Nursing Discontinuance. And again, remember, this is a first reading, so we're trying to make sure we have all the information that we're going to be needing. Maybe suggestions if there's parts that aren't clear that we need to have. And I turn it over to Senator Milligan.
Thank you. So I should say, since we're on the topic of discontinuance, I'm very sorry that I missed the last Senate meeting. I was doing my doing jury duty, basically. So unfortunately, I missed the Senate. I'm very sorry about that. So I wasn't here for the first discontinuance you got to consider, but I'm glad to be here for the continued discussion of discontinuance issues. So. This discontinuance proposal is, as you see from the materials in front of you, is a proposal to discontinue the Direct Entry Masters of Nursing program. And EPC reviewed the materials that were brought forward to it. As with the previous discontinuance I provided to you, it's actually in the packet in front of you. There's a recommendation from EPC that details what EPC's decision was, as well as detailing the rationale or the key points taken into account in making that decision. So actually, that is the back of your packet that's in front of you. It's the last two pages. And so you might notice that EPC voted against recommending the proposed discontinuance. And so the vote was 0 in favor of the proposed discontinuance, or 0 in favor of not recommending it, 6 against, 2 abstentions. So it's a little bit tricky in how it's worded. With this particular program, EPC felt that the discontinuance was really essentially a matter of resources, and primarily faculty resources, but also a lack of other resources that were necessary for the program to be successful. And after reviewing the program documents and the comments from affiliated staff, and after holding a public hearing and discussing at length the issue, EPC decided that this was, in fact, in the past had been a very successful program. It provides, it fills a significant need. And so that based on that, EPC could not support discontinuing it. So instead, they voted against recommending the proposed discontinuance. I do want to emphasize, though, that at earlier levels of review, the proposal for discontinuance was supported at the school level, at the graduate studies level, by the dean of the school. But note that all of those levels of support expressed some degree of regret or disappointment that what should be a viable program was slated for discontinuance. And you should also note that the program hasn't admitted a cohort since 2010. And so there aren't really students to teach out. The program has been essentially suspended or mothballed for a period of time due to a lack of resources. And so what's happening now is really following through with discontinuing something that can't really remain on the books, especially from the perspective of accrediting agencies, if it's not going to be an active program. As what Senate needs to do now is to review the materials, let us know if there are any additional materials that you need or questions that you need answered for the second reading, and then at the second reading, Senate's job is to make a recommendation to the president as to whether the program should be discontinued, whether the recommendation should be for or against the proposed discontinuance. So it's perfectly acceptable for that recommendation to be different from the EPC recommendation or to be similar to the EPC recommendation. I might also note that it's the form that needs to take is a motion from the floor explaining, you know, noting the position that Senate wants to take when that happens, and that it would be perfectly acceptable to attach additional statements of justification to that, especially since Chair Senghas is going to be taking the Senate's decision, the Senate's recommendation, and forwarding that in a summary form to the President for his consideration. And I'm sure you probably went through this last time, but what happens at that point, according to the discontinuance policy, is that the President takes those materials, forwards them to the Chancellor for his review and comment. That returns to the President, and then the President makes a decision about termination or not of the program. So that's also, as you can see, the Senate clock is ticking, and so it would be very important for the Senate to take action on this matter during this academic semester. Okay, so should we turn it over to Professor Roberts to talk a little bit about the context of this decision?
I think that would be appropriate at this time. Okay. Senator Roberts?
Thank you very much. You have an additional document in your packet that is the department's response to EPC committee on the discontinuation of the direct entry master's program. And this also includes some recommendation from XCOM, which we really appreciated, to talk about the influences of continuing the program on the department, on our other programs that we currently offer, on the faculty, and our two accrediting bodies. We are both nationally and state accredited. So that's the last document that you got today. I believe it's in the front of your packet. So in an effort not to repeat what has happened, this was a very viable program. It did start on self-support in our first year, and we were able to support it very handsomely with everything that we needed, including all these influences that you see on this two-page document. At that time, it was decided that it was at a time at the university when our provost, not this provost, when our provost felt as if it would be important to have this on state side for several reasons, including the FTE. And so we moved it to stateside. This is a program that, just to give you a little bit about what it is, the student comes in with a bachelor's in something else, anything else, with their prerequisites, gets their RN curriculum and their master's curriculum, and leaves this university with the ability, once they take their national exam, with the ability to practice nursing at the master's level. Wildly popular, 10 times the number of applications than spots available on any given application period. The problem is our dwindling faculty and resources. We have several other programs, one that includes a master's. I have the director of our FNT master's program here today, one that's another baccalaureate degree. I have the director of that program here today, and I am the director of our traditional baccalaureate program. Each of them have very specific requirements by our accrediting bodies for directors with subsequent reassignment time, assistant directors with subsequent reassignment time, and specialty, as I've outlined in the document, on five different areas of nursing that must be covered in order to run the program. So I have stated in here that we need four hires. And the reason for that is that we need psych mental health, pediatrics, community public health, and the thrust of our master's direct entry program was clinical nurse leader, we currently do not have a clinical nurse leader on staff at all. So that's the justification for that. So along with those hires, when we originally started the program, without the faculty budget, the budget came out to about $250,000, what we needed, and that's what we proposed when we went and proposed the program through self-support. So that includes much of the program is also, there involves clinical sites, some of it's online, so IT. It involves those relationships with all our community partners. And so all the influences that we could think of at the moment, and I'm sure we could probably add addendum after addendum here, we put together. So I want to thank XCOM. I want to thank Melinda Barnard also for her input at XCOM to help formulate these ideas.
Okay, so we have 5 minutes remaining in this business item. So if you have questions, if you could make them as direct and to the point as possible, and any further could be emailed to Senator Milligan or to Senator Roberts for further distribution if necessary of its materials, and we can bring that to next week. So do I have any questions? I don't see anyone on the speaker's list yet.
Just a quick question for clarification. It's about staffing implications.
Yes.
Can you please comment or bring back next week the anticipated impact discontinuing the program will have on Sonoma State staff? For example, could discontinuance result in the loss or reduction of staff positions or result in staff reassignment or reclassification?
Senator Madani.
Thank you. I have a question maybe for the EPC chair, and then possibly more political and rhetorical than to the point. Because I feel very badly for the nursing program that had a really great thing going and it can't be sustained because of lack of resources, and EPC is recommending not to discontinue it, but it's starving to death, and it seems to me like you're ordering it to live, despite the fact that it's starving. So...
In synopsis.
Thank you.
Resuscitate. We used the word resuscitate.
I don't really know where my question is, except that in the future, how do we manage situations like this where it's resources, not will, that's preventing the program from being successful?
Yeah. So I guess we can bring it up in the future. In fact, I would make a comment here that in part, this would have been the traditional role of APC because it was the one that would deal with what's happening to us as an overall system, right, and all the programs and patterns that we're seeing. Senator Rand.
So it seems to me that if resources aren't provided, that this program will die, and that nursing needs it to die for its accreditation. So is EPC making a political statement that, yes, we know it's going to die, but against our will?
I think it's important to read EPC's decision in the context of all of the decisions going up to this point, and also that it's a recommendation rather than an approval. And so it is, I think, fair to read it as a point being made.
Christian.
So I've got a question for you, Dr. Roberts. So if I'm reading this correctly, that if the program stays but does not get the necessary hires, the loss of accreditation will hurt other nursing students currently enrolled.
Correct.
Okay. Any other speakers? I'm not seeing any. What do you know? So... I don't think we have enough time to get a report in before, actually we do, because our next time is actually at 4. So we'll return to the report. So let us go to Vice Chair Healy. Let's go to Vice Chair Healy.
Because we have a number of other reports that might be of more interest, I will defer mine and email.
I think I'll take this moment to have us actually jump to the end of year report for the professional development subcommittee. Normally this might have been done under FSAC business, but they're deferring this week. Is Ed still here? Yeah, there you are. Okay.
I'll try to keep this brief because I know you are very limited on time this week. Yes, this is our annual report from the Professional Development Subcommittee looking at professional development issues on campus. And the process dates back to spring of 2013 when there was a faculty retreat that we co-sponsored on professional development, trying to get feedback from faculty. That was followed up by an impressionistic summary of some of the comments that were made at that retreat, as well as a second faculty retreat that featured workshops and some of the key areas of interest. Around the same time that we gave our last report, a couple things happened. The first was that Ann Steckel was hired in her position and more attention was given to the faculty center. And that had a huge impact in addressing some of the issues that we brought up in our previous report. So if you look at the second and third pages of that report, you will note that this is a document that Ann provided us with last fall, mentioning some of the key areas that we brought up and what her, the faculty center, and other entities on campus have done to address some of those issues. So clearly, there's been some progress. That brings us to the recommendations, and we outlined several key areas, five to be exact. The most important issue that we felt that needs to be looked at in the upcoming year is that of technology. There continues, as everyone knows, to be significant barriers in the effort to encourage innovative uses of technology in the classroom. We do recognize that there has been progress made in this area. For instance, the Technology Task Force, which has given opportunities for staff and administration to dialogue. That has certainly been one thing, and we also know that, of course, there's a timetable for smart classrooms to be completed, I believe, by the end of 2016. But we would like to encourage further beyond that, that there be a technology master plan for this campus that involves all areas of the campus community to discuss and come up with a master plan, not only for purchasing technology, but for deciding what kind of campus we want to be in the area of technology. We also would like to create a new kind of relationship in the years ahead between faculty and IT, one beyond the one that currently exists, where it's essentially something's broken, we need it fixed, and that's the dialogue that happens. We would like it to be more of a conversation between the two entities that would result in innovative teaching techniques that rely on technology. We also further encourage an increase in stipends for professional development workshops. That did happen this year, and we know from direct feedback from people who received those stipends that they were deeply appreciative of this, particularly because the workload issue for faculty in this campus is still very heavy. And so to be recognized for taking the time to improve your teaching methods is something that we want to continue to encourage. Also, we want to continue to encourage that professional development be given serious consideration and encouragement in the RTP process. For instance, we feel that sometimes there's too much emphasis given to SETIs when we talk about teaching performance, and we need to encourage people in the tenure track that taking part in professional development workshops is certainly something that should be considered as part of meeting your teaching requirements and improving yourself as an instructor. Also, increase staffing for professional development-related programs, such as the Faculty Center and for the Center for Community Engagement, both of which are operating pretty much on a shoestring and could certainly increase their outreach with a little more in the way of staffing. And then finally, more opportunities for dialogue. We would like to see, for instance, such as we had this past week, the chair of the faculty and the provost lunches that they have every month was a joint meeting with professional development subcommittee, and we talked about those kind of issues. Unfortunately, it was not well attended other than by committee members for PDS. So we would like to see more of those kind of opportunities for people to express what some of their concerns are. We also feel it would be important to continue to have co-sponsored faculty retreats with PDS in the upcoming academic year. And also just general opportunities, as we discussed in our meeting last week, to have faculty from different disciplines have the opportunity to just have conversation, because we've found that just the conversation alone can often lead to collaborations and innovative teaching techniques. So that's essentially the report in a nutshell, and I would also welcome anybody who has any ideas for areas you would like to see addressed to please send me an email, because at our final meeting of the year, we will be discussing ways that we can increase professional development on campus.
Thank you. So unless there's an immediate response or question about the report, I would like to move on. But before doing so, I would like to express on behalf of the Senate and the faculty our appreciation of PDS. They've been doing an awful lot there. I think the Faculty Center has become really a vital place for all kinds of professional development and work and collaboration. And it's been a real success. And part of that has to do with the collaboration between PDS and STECL. So thank you. All right, so let's move to the next report. Yes, we have time for that. Neil Markley, on behalf of the Administration of Finance, anything to report?
Very quickly, tonight is Take Back the Night for anyone interested at 8 o'clock. Obviously, it's a campaign against sexual violence. Please do try to make that if you can. With that, I'll...
Any questions for Administration and Finance? So, Associated Students.
I only have one item to address, and that is that this is my last meeting in my official capacity as Executive Vice President. I'll be here at the following meeting, kind of just finishing out the rest of the year, but next week we will be inducting and swearing in next year's Associated Students Senate. So be on the lookout for a new group of student leaders coming around, and make them feel welcome, and we'll see them all next year.
That's with the champagne. Oh, yeah, that's with the champagne. Thank you. Any questions for Associated Students? All right. Senator Morimoto.
A couple of meetings ago when I brought up the tutoring center and how you successfully got the student fee to go to supporting the tutoring center, you said that you're planning to meet with the provost, and I forget someone else, to talk about finding a more sustainable way of funding the tutorial center. And I was wondering if that meeting took place, and if so, what kind of suggestions or ideas came out of that meeting?
So the provost, Vice President Larry Schlereth, myself, and our current Vice President of Finance, Adam Rosenkranz, met, and we had that type of discussion, whereas we have a long-term vision of possibly creating, and again, this is also including other people on campus, and especially the Dr. Leslie Shelton, who heads the Tutorial Center. But there's possible plans of creating an additional space for the Tutorial Center, but also a short-term plan of extending tutoring hours next year, as well as the possibility of hiring a coordinator to support those extended hours.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
Did you get a commitment from either of those offices to providing funding?
The provost verbally told us that they will be providing an additional fund for that coordinator.
Okay. Seeing no other hands, let's move to the Vice President of Student Affairs. So,
good afternoon, everyone. Sorry. Getting choked up. It's almost the last meeting. Thank you for all your hard work. I know right now as faculty it's final exam times, and those papers are piling up for you. Our students are exhibiting the stress, and I am seeing them in judicial affairs as well. So I don't know if those two things are directly correlated, but they might be. I went to a really nice ceremony right before I came here for our students registered with DSS. those that have achieved a 3.0 or more throughout their time. They received cords, so it was a really wonderful celebration. About 25 of the students were there. They also merit scholarships. One of our students received that. It was one of our students that had also studied abroad, had gone in our United Nations program, Model UN program, had gone on that, and was a presidential scholar. So, but clearly did not let her disability get in her way of success. So thank you for all the help all of you have given those students to help them succeed. Other than that, we're winding down Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and there's been quite a buzz on campus. Thank you for your support for that, and good luck with finals.
Any questions for Student Affairs? We have 5 minutes. Is that enough to do anything from statewide senators? Okay, so then let's go to our statewide senators.
Thank you very much, Chair Stinghouse. I just wanted to let you know that I went over to the Capitol last week. A statewide senate asked me to attend the assembly education committee and speak in support of Assemblywoman Bonilla, who's from Contra Costa's bill on open educational resources to help decrease the cost of textbooks and other supplies for our students.
And from we had our interim committee meetings last Friday via teleconference, and just to keep you updated, the Academic Affairs Committee statewide is continuing its work on trying to figure out what to do with upper division GE under the challenge of community college bachelor's degrees in AB 386, the course match mandate that courses from host campus be treated the same on the home campus as they are on the host campus. So we're working on a resolution to try to clarify. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for our statewide senators? Seeing none, and given how little time there is to the time certain, I think we'll just move to that next time certain. This is on the proposed change to the Senate formula for representation and duties of senators, and this is a first reading. So remember that we're trying to look to see as the information that we need here. Do we need further information? Do we need clarifications from some of the materials? And Senator Wick is chair of Faculty Standards and Affairs, but this is a task force that's coming out of Structure and Functions. So I'll be handing it over to Senator Wick and Structure and Functions Chair Doug. Oh, here he is. Okay, so he's at the table.
He left.
All right. But the other two members of the committee are Laurel Holmstrom and myself, but I'm probably going to stay out of it as much as possible. So with that, I hand it over to Richard and Doug.
So I noticed Chair Bippinger is looking at me, so I think he wants me to proceed. Thank you. So what we're proposing, what we're bringing forward to the Senate today is a proposal that will be looking at changing the formula for deciding the representation of the Senate membership. In terms of their school representatives and the at-large representatives. And along with this, then there will be a need to make a constitutional amendment. And along with that, there would be a need to make a bylaw change for the duties of those representatives. So the proposal basically, by the way, if you haven't already figured out, it's the last three pages of your packet, starting on the first page, which is the memo. The first two little paragraphs make pretty much the nut of the argument. And in the second paragraph, what we're looking at is instead of using the current formula for our representation for the Senate membership, we're proposing instead to go to just a specific number for individual schools. And by so doing, therefore, we would have to also then make changes to the duties of those representatives because there's going to be basically a shifting in how schools are going to be represented on the Senate. The rest of the page there basically talks about some of the major reasons why we're proposing this formula. First that we notice is that the idea of communication with a large number of representatives from numbers of schools the way in which those representatives communicate to those schools is actually diluted. What we're finding in actuality is that rather than having a representative or a number of representatives go to, say, the council of department chairs or go visit different departments, we find representatives figure somebody else is doing it. And so in the end, there's a dilution of who actually makes that commitment to report back to their schools in terms of what's going on in the Senate. In the end, people are busy, people basically let someone else do it, and in the end, there's very little communication going from the Senate back to the schools. It varies from school to school. Some schools are very good, others are not so good. Along with that, we also noticed that the current representatives at the Senate do not really represent their school as a body so much or have a strategy representing the school's sort of viewpoints on Senate issues, rather that they really represent themselves or their departments. And so therefore, rather than getting viewpoints at the Senate representing school viewpoints, what we're getting is really a diversity of viewpoints across the number of representatives within a school, which pretty much almost matches the diversity of viewpoints we get from the Senate as a whole. So the idea of representation for a school, providing a school voice, really isn't there when you have that many representatives. Along with that, we're finding that we think that by having fewer representatives, we'll, to some degree, reverse that process. Fewer representatives means that, one, there's only one or two people who have the responsibility to report back to the schools, and one or two people who can carry that school's will back to the Senate. Now, we also know that there's going to be some concern about, well, these may be lost opportunities for faculty voice or for opportunities for service, especially among tenure-track faculty. But we also note that in terms of the larger Senate reorganization, we're finding that, of course, there are many seats that are still going unfulfilled, and so we're hoping that this would then shift some of those needs for service to some of those other state and subcommittees. On the second page of that memo, we show then the actual proposal in terms of what the current Senate has in terms of its representation, and the proposal in terms of where the numbers would look like. What we have in italics is where those changes would occur. And then on the third page is the proposed constitutional change, that is in terms of making a formula for the Senate representation in terms of how it's currently done, which is this archaic formula, which was put in place, I think, from what Laurel tells me, from many years ago, when we had a much different Senate, a much different faculty, to where we would actually now just dictate how many representatives would be coming from each of the schools. And then the fourth page indicates the proposed bylaw changes, which would represent what the duties for the school representatives or in the duties of the at-large representative would look like if we were to follow this proposal. And then we know that there are other issues that we're not really getting to, but Laura was very good as we were going through the faculty reorganization meetings with both the schools and with the various faculty governance committees. Over and over again, we kind of get the same kind of questions, and so Laura was very good at putting together this reorganization FAQ for you as well. So if you have other additional questions, we think they're probably included on that sheet as well.
Okay, so I would like to remind everyone that this is a first reading, so we're trying to get issues of clarity, if there's questions about any confusing materials, additional materials you would like to have brought to the decision. We have a speakers list that's about five or six folks deep already, so I will start with Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first recommendation is that you be explicit about the new formula for allocation of seats on the Senate among the schools. Maybe I'm missing it, but it seems to me that you're still going by school size so that the larger schools have two and the smaller schools have one. I think that should be made explicit, even though you don't have an FTEF formula going on there. And perhaps add language, or at least consider adding language, that you will, if it is based on school size, that there be some kind of census every 10 years or 5 years or whatever, to make sure that the allocation remains true to the reality. And that's, of course, similar to, forgive me, political scientists here, House of Representatives representation being based on population. My second question
the second specific suggestion is with regard, it's on the last page, the proposed change duties of at-large representatives to the Academic Senate, that first sentence, where it says, to identify issues that cut across schools and to look for patterns, potential consensus, or differing implications. That's pretty general language. I'm not exactly sure what it is. And I understand what the words mean, but I'm not exactly sure what they mean in relationship to the duties of a representative. So you might want some clarification there. And my third point, and this is more just an observation than a request for clarification, it seems to me that the underlying assumption here is that there's, or maybe there's a struggle going on in trying to get members of the Senate to represent as many viewpoints as possible. And I can understand asking senators to report that in their school this perspective was, you know, that I went to my department chair's meeting and this perspective was expressed or that perspective was expressed. But when it comes down to two other things, one, actively participating in the
Senate. Could I remind you that we have 10 minutes left and about 8 more people on the speakers list, so please go ahead.
Thank you, sir. when you talk about actively participating fully in Senate proceedings and it comes to how to vote, I'm not sure how that dovetails with the particular view of representation that seems to be undergirding the proposal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Senator Roudois.
Thank you. I appreciate the committee's efforts to deal with the historically low, I think, number of tenure-track faculty in a realistic way, and that entails some sacrifices in representation. I do think the current policy has some merits that Senator Nelson described as well, which is it's invariant. The policy doesn't require revision if there are great changes in the sizes of the schools or even in the organization and number of the schools. It would stand as is. Whereas the new policy doesn't have a stated rationale or guidelines, and it calls out the schools by name. So it would be wonderful if there could at least be a rationale for how to recalibrate the policy, if not just a formula that holds up regardless of changes we might see.
Thank you. Senator Roberts.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the hard work on the policy and support it in concept. One of the things that I would like to ask about, and I know this was on our agenda last time, Senator Wittkus, to talk about the new structure of standing committees, and we didn't get to that, but I see that we went from 4 to 3, and as we mentioned that it was a loss to lose APC, given some academic planning that we ought to have on campus, I'm concerned that we went from 4 standing to 3, and
I'm going to interrupt here because the whole issue of committee reorganization was separated out, and we'll be dealing with committee reorganizations next year. So we're just talking about this body here. Yes, I don't know if that was...
Point of order.
Okay, so
we do have 4 standing committees. Mm-hmm. Only one is vacant, so then this should say 4. And it says 3.
Okay. Good. Thanks. But I did want to remind people, originally we have been talking about it all, and we have decided to chunk it to make it easier. Senator Brannon.
Thank you. My understanding is that FAQ stands for frequently asked questions. And one of these questions that apparently your committee was asked frequently is that we are hiring more faculty. Won't that help with vacancies? My understanding is we're hiring less than or equal to 6 new faculty. I can't imagine that we're not losing greater than or equal to 6. So really, there's a frequent number of people on this campus that think the faculty is growing next year? All right.
Okay, Senator Garvey.
Thank you. I was wondering about the explanation or rationale for reducing the number of SSP senators from 3 to 2. I didn't see any information in this document as to why that decision was included in this proposal. So I was hoping to see something like that in the next revision.
Okay, thank you. Senator Watt?
Similarly, there's also a reduction in the number of lecture representatives, I believe. Yeah, it goes from 3 to 2, and I can only imagine the number of lecturers on campus is going up as the number of tenure-track faculty is going down. So again, some rationale there would be useful. And just a quick comment, because I don't see this in the rationale, and I think it's important, sort of dovetailing with something Senator Nelson said, In our U.S. Congress, there are sort of two different versions of representation that the two houses tend to take. One is, I'm your House representative. I'd like to go back and hear from all of you about what you want me to do. The other form is more frequently taken in the Senate, where you voted for me because you pressed my judgment, so I'm going to go and represent you with my judgment. And it's not clear, given that the way that the reorg is actually moving us more in a Senate-like direction with the numbers, it's not clear to me what form of representation we actually are expecting from those representatives, so some language about that might be useful.
Okay, thank you. Senator Moonwoman.
Yeah, at the risk of echoing some of what just been said, below the first category, below the representatives of schools category, there are very few reductions, but a couple of them concern me. The one that I want to speak to is the reduction of even one of the lecturer senators, given that there are now, when three was first established as the number, there were fewer lecturers on campus than there are now, both in number and in proportion to the tenure-track faculty and FTEF. So I wonder what the rationale is for reducing that at all.
Thank you. Senator Milligan.
Yes, thank you. I've noticed that there's language associated with the numbers, the reduction in numbers for the formula for Senate representation. But most of the other numerical changes are dealt with in the attached table. And I was wondering whether at a practical level, what we're being asked to do is to amend the Constitution by inserting a table to illustrate the other changes in numerical representation. So I'm not quite clear on whether there should be language detailing what those changes are, because the language that's been presented only relates to some of the numerical changes, not all of them.
All right, Senator
Kuna. Yeah, I'm just wondering what the task force thinking was on changing Article 2.1. The old policy said one senator for every 20 full-time equivalent faculty. And I appreciate the effort to reduce the numbers, but I'm wondering why you didn't just raise it to say one senator for every 30 or for every 35, because what was nice about the old policy is that a built-in corrective mechanism. As the numbers in the schools changed, the number of senators would automatically reflect that, whereas the new policy sets in stone for all time, you know, the numbers, and so 10 years down the road or whatever it is, these may not reflect the current situation, and then once things have been set for like that, it becomes a lot harder to change them. So I was just wondering what the thinking behind, if there was a reason I'm not getting for changing it, making a more simple change.
All right, thank you. Senator Glasgow?
I just have a question about implementation. I see the FAQ about implementation and how it affects committees, but nothing about how it affects the Senate itself. And I was, just hoping, like, will it be by attrition or the reduction? Say, from A&H going from 5 to 2, will it be, which is my school, will it be by attrition or will you immediately cut 3 positions?
We forgot the firing squad list.
Firing squad, sorry.
So I don't have any other speakers on the speakers list, and so because it's first reading and it's input, and as I was about to do, I was going to say, given that we've hit all the speakers, I didn't know if Senator Wickes or Chair Levinger wanted to comment if any of these are easily responded to in the few minutes we have remaining.
Well, I can respond quickly to the last comment, because we don't have it in here. But the idea would be that there would have to be a transition period, and that transition period would take into account the fact that as people roll off of their positions, those positions would not be filled. But as people just are being elected currently to fill a three-year position, those positions would have to be honored, of course. So we'd have to be through a period of transition to get down to those numbers if we were to accept this proposal.
Thanks.
And were there any other points that could be addressed in a minute or two and without consultation of the committee, the task force, I should say?
Not that I have.
Anybody else?
Okay. Well, maybe just one quick thing. I mean, another large point about doing this is, you know, we have several tables of leaders here, and as chair of structure and functions, I've actually been on that committee now for three and a half years, and we always have trouble getting people for committees. So part of the reason to reduce this body was to get some of you all into these slots on these important committees that we have.
Senator Ortiz?
I was just going to say with the transitional period, since the old way does have some representative schools be high in number, I don't know how the numbers will actually play out, but if one school happens to get there too faster, there could be two from one school hitting the new way, but there could be four still from science and tech or from A&H. So that would create inequality.
All right. So Senator Watt, and this will have to be the last one because we're in the last minute.
Just a super quick comment more than a question, which is to point out the value of having more than just two seats from a school. I started as a senator as I think in my second or third year here as a very junior faculty. And I was actually assured by my dean at the time that I didn't have to say anything my first year. So I didn't have to worry about, you know, would this affect my career if I took a stance on something controversial. I think if we want to have junior faculty involved while they're still technically quote unquote vulnerable, I think having safety in numbers can be useful. It also is a great training ground of learning about how this university works.
Okay, thank you. So this has been a healthy round of input, and you should be seeing more materials by the next Senate meeting. We'll try to respond as best as we can to all of those. In the meantime, if you have further thoughts, inputs, maybe even ideas of solutions to address some of the various problems that have been raised, we would so love for your input. We keep trying to ask that. It's okay to say, I have problems with that, but it's not so okay to say no and then not help us, because this is our body and we really need to do something about it. We have a standing committee on hiatus and other committees having trouble meeting quorum, and it's clearly status quo is not sufficient. Okay, thank you. So now we will move to our time certain of 4:15. We have our guests in the room, so Dean Ayala, would you like to come up?
As they're coming up, can I just thank the task force for all of their work?
Yes. They've been putting in a lot of work. Okay, so we have some members. We have our guests coming up. So now we're turning to item number four, the Candel discontinuance. This is a second reading. So here's where we are. It's appropriate for us to be making position statements on whether people feel like it's a good idea or a bad idea. It's also okay to be raising points of clarification. We're trying to make a decision today as to what our recommendation would be, and if we wanted to qualify that recommendation in any way so that it would be useful for the president and the chancellor as they face the decisions. So with that said, I turn it over again to our Senator Milligan from EPC.
I was just going to point out, we expect a lot of, if you could be like really
obvious,
we not want not only whether you want to speak, but the right order.
Okay. And when we do get to that point, try to be as direct to the point as you can be so that everybody gets a chance to be in. If it gets too problematic, I may end up privileging those who have not spoken yet so we can hear more voices. So with that,
Thank you very much. And again, I'm sorry I missed the last Senate meeting due to jury duty, and thanks very much to Armin Galinsky, who stepped in my absence to represent EPC in this Candel matter and in other EPC business that day. So I think as Chair Senkos set up, because this is a second reading, I think it's really important to think about factors that would weigh into your decision and that the Senate as a whole can take into account in making its recommendation. At the first reading, you received EPC's recommendation, and as was clear, and I know that you discussed last time, it was a split decision, and so that's why the document that EPC crafted to provide to you represented points, a range of points of view that were made by the members of EPC. And I know that that presented a little bit of confusion as to why there were both pros and cons, but that's because EPC members had differing points of view as indicated in the vote. And when EPC crafted the recommendation, which was done and and then approved by the committee as a whole, it was very important to attempt to represent that range of perspectives. Also, I should note that the document that EPC brought forward did not intend to be an exhaustive assessment of all of the issues, the pros and cons that might go into making a recommendation about this discontinuance. As you saw, the documentation was quite substantial that we reviewed. And so what you got from EPC was a sheet that emphasized the highlights that came out in our extensive discussion about how to proceed. So I do want to emphasize that there may be other points that you might want to take into account that were not mentioned in the EPC document, and that would be absolutely appropriate based on your own reading of the materials.
Okay, and before we move to Dean Aiello for any additional statement, I would like to remind you that if you look on the front page of your agenda packet, you will see a link. And so if you happen to have an electronic device so that you can get access to stuff, or if you haven't had a chance before and have one with you, I do encourage you to pull up those devices and get yourselves able to access the documents. So that may help the discussion. So with that, Dean Aiello, do you want to?
Sure. I'd be glad to say a few words. I also am prepared to answer questions and have discussions. Today, when you consider this discontinuance, I want you to think about two points that I made last time. One is, where do you start in a process like this? Where does one begin? Who are the people that need to be involved in making that decision? And in this case with the CANDO program, I started with my educational leadership faculty. They are the folks who, when asked who can be the director of the program, they said they can be the director. No one else could be the director. They could be the director because it's an educational leadership program. And with that information, I began the discussion about discontinuance with them. And they were split on the decision. Paul, who could be here next time, he's teaching and doing this other thing. He can be here next week if we really want to speak to him. He was present with me when we were unilaterally told about the increase in student fees for UC Davis, for the students in the CANDO program, that the money was going to be redirected at UC Davis. He was there in the room when the dean and the assistant dean talked about hiring for Kendall, and there's a faculty process for hiring and bringing in people into Kendall, but we were not consulted on our end about that process. And he was in the room when we were told that our budget was cut by the amount syndicated here, $225,000. And the joint partnership dissolved at that point. He no longer could be the director. I coaxed them to be director until Vicki was ready to step up. So the question is, where do you start? I believe he started in the right spot. The second thing I want you to consider are, who are our students and who do we impact in the School of Education? Yesterday I wrote a letter to about 24 people in our service area in Ukiah. Who are interested in an educational leadership program, and I've been telling them, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with this process that we have here for the Kandel program, what the decisions are going to be. But even though you're in our service area, I can't make any promises that we can run a program with you. They are our students, and that number of students, 30, is more than the number of students from our service area that have gone through the CANDEL program. And I think about 30 students who currently are in a educational leadership class that's meeting now. Those people are going to be the principals, they're going to be the assistant principals in the schools where you will send your children, where our students of Sonoma State will send their children. This is our focus, and given the structure of this program, given how we hire faculty within the CSU around FTS that are designated to us, I can't grow this program. I can't grow my educational leadership program. And those are the things that I think that you need to consider when you make your decision.
Okay, so we have a speakers list coming, and I would encourage you, especially if you have questions that would help you vote on any decision, or if you are considering a motion that might have some content that that you would propose that we add to that recommendation, please start working on that. If it's anything more than a sentence or so, a written form of that would be great to send up to our Senate analysts so we can make sure that for the record we're getting what's actually being proposed and for any votes on that. So we will start with Senator Music and then go to Ortiz and then Bouvet. Senator Music.
Yeah, thank you. My question is about staffing implications. The proposal mentions the impact of Davis changing the administrative support structure and the impact that had on staff of the Sonoma State, but did not indicate the staff implications of the program if this continued. Can you please comment on the anticipated impact discontinuing the program will have on Sonoma State staff? For example, could discontinuance result in loss or reduction of staff positions or result in staff reassignment or reclassification?
Staff as opposed to faculty? So when UC Davis cut our budget, we had to let Rosemary Colton go. And we were able to actually bring her into the school as our receptionist. Currently, $0 of the Candel budget go to pay for any staff.
So you do not anticipate a change in the staffing as a result of discontinuing? Thank you.
Okay, Senator Ortiz?
Thank you. Forgive me if this question is premature, but I know it would help me in my voting process. Considering the arguments that were made for both why we should not discontinue the program and that the way it does involve and give back and benefit the immediate community, how it brings attention to the School of Education and the benefits of having a doctoral program at Sonoma State University, although those seem to counter to go against or the arguments of why we should discontinue it seem to go against those benefits, considering we seem to feel neglected in this partnership. And knowing that Sacramento State used to be a third partner and that in the lines of one of the documents it stated how since it is a partnership, we don't receive funding from the CSU, is it a possibility that once this is no longer a strain on faculty and financial resources, we could have our own doctoral program?
So,
yes, go ahead.
Okay. So there are multiple questions embedded in that, okay? I wanna address the first issue about the significance of a doctoral program within the CSU, a joint doctoral program, and how it relates to the School of Education and how we are viewed in the community. So yesterday I had the Napa Valley, the Napa superintendent in my office. I had a representative from Sonoma Valley there, and I had a representative from Calistoga, the superintendent from Calistoga, and also one of the HR people. We didn't talk about Candel. That's not what's of interest to them. What's of interest to them in relationship to the School of Education is, can you fill positions for us? We have teaching positions. Napa was looking for 6 people, bilingual people, and Sonoma is looking for 5 people. Can the School of Education, our critical mission, our core mission, can we do that? And I told them no. I told them that we had our 200 students in here, about 90 last Friday, 90 got jobs, but I told them, no, I can't do that. I said, but you can go look at East Bay, you can go to San Francisco, you can go up to Chico and ask them, I can facilitate that conversation. We can't serve our service area, the demands that they have in place. The other areas around educational leadership. I'm proud that we have an ed doc program. Don't get me wrong. Do I think it's gonna tarnish us a little bit or make us not as bright? Yes, it will. But it's more important for us to focus on our local area and put our resources there. And this is not a black and white decision. This is a gray decision. You have to measure both benefits and losses on both sides. And to me, the more I think about it, the more I talk about it, it is clear what we need to do with this. Did I answer your question? Oh, and the second part of your question about, I don't know how we're going to proceed. We could have conversations about another doctoral program. We don't currently have the resources available to do that. During the early 2000s, there were grants that were offered by the CSU to launch these programs. We frankly haven't pursued those or looked at those. Though Paul has talked about it a little bit, but it's not something that I put any money or initiative or energy or time on.
So it's not in here.
Yeah. Well, and also, Carolyn Nelson, my dean buddy from East Bay, just launched another doctoral program, Education in Social Justice, and she kind of took my thunder because we were thinking about some kind of something like that if we were to pursue this. So I would recommend students there.
Senator Bovet?
So my main concern has to do with the diminishing resource argument that was put forward in the main document as the justification for discontinuing the program. Because if I look at the table for the budget for 2013-2014, the total salaries and expenses that are listed sum up to $161,000. So it seems like even if the funds have gone down to $165,000, it still covers the expenses that have been incurred on campus. So I just don't understand why we have to shut the program if the current resources, which might have decreased also because of budget cuts that the UC Davis campus went through, it doesn't seem like we don't have enough resources being granted by Davis to support what's currently going on at Sonoma. And my second question related is, it seems to be self-supported, while that was not necessarily presented this way. And it was also my understanding that other campuses that stopped their collaboration with UC Davis, like Sac State, created their own doctoral programs. So if we don't have the resources, and we don't need to actually put resources in that program so far, we don't really have an alternative that other CSUs had when they decided to end the relationship. And I was also a bit puzzled when, in several of the documents presented, we presented those students in the Kendall program as not CSU students, even though they were taught by 7 faculty that are on our campus. And so are they supposed to be just students of CSU because they pay fees at CSU? So I, talking to some of the people who were involved in the Kendall program, I think for them it's a bit disheartening to think that they've been taught to non-CSU students just because the fee structure was not, directed towards Sonoma. So right now I just have a tough time buying the diminishing resource argument for discontinuing the program because the data we're given in the main program does not support that argument.
Thank you. Dr. McEwen.
Good afternoon. My name is Dave McEwen. I'm in political science, and I also teach in the Kandel program. I've written a letter about the process for discontinuance that I believe is in that rather expansive packet. In addition, I have also been involved in this process from the beginning. Been teaching in Kandel for a couple of years. Vicky Montero couldn't be here today, so I thought I would come and discuss some elements about the process and specific questions. I listened to the first reading and also the recording that was held at XCOM of that discussion as well. And I would urge the Senate a couple of different points of information to consider. One is that this process has not been one that has involved faculty. As a core Kandel faculty member, there was one meeting that I was called to where there was an announcement made that we were going to discontinue the program. That announcement was made by the dean. There was one of the 7 faculty members in support of that decision at the time. There's a record to show, I can certainly, with the permission of the faculty members involved, certainly demonstrate that and show that to you. In addition, the process of discontinuance allows anyone, I believe this was a discussion before EPC, anyone to bring forth that move. And there hasn't been any move from the faculty to do this. There's been the dean that has decided to do this, and I would argue without the support of the faculty, or at least the split support of the faculty. As someone who teaches at UC Davis in this program, teaches a wide swath of students, evidenced in the packet by their wide disparity and demographic background of these individuals, I can tell you I don't feel like a lesser individual when I'm over there teaching and making demands of these students. And this brings the broader point that I want to bring forth to the Senate. This whole process has been characterized, and facts have been presented which are not facts. I have a point-by-point rebuttal, which I believe Senator Rannan asked for at one of the meetings, maybe ex-com on these points, to refute most of what's in the report. The previous senator just talked about the relevance and the points, but I would ask you, as members of the Senate, to look with a very critical eye to the information that's been presented to you, because you are being presented information in a certain light. Faculty have not bought into that, and we haven't participated in that. And as part of the faculty governance process, think hard about critically about the information that's being presented to you, because it is not factually correct that the program was cut in half. The budget was not cut in half. It is not correct that the program has to expel resources. SSU commits under the MOU for $20,000 a year to put forth to the program, which it has never had to do. So there are several elements of the debate that are just factually incorrect as this process has moved along, and faculty in Candel, core faculty, have not bought into it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Madavi.
Thank you. I'm the chair of the department which houses the Ed Leadership faculty, Paul and Vicki. I haven't personally taught in Candel, and I know peripherally some of the things about the budget that are going on. But my concern, and I'm speaking from my perspective of the chair of that department, I can say that I don't know to what extent the dean was consulting with other faculty members who have taught in Candel, but I know that I have been involved in conversations with Dean Ayala for a year or more, two, where we've considered, do we want to stay with this, do we not? So this all came as no surprise to me and to the faculty in my department. I also want to speak to the workloads of the faculty, Paul and Vicki specifically, in my department. Both of them, because the Candel program is sort of soft money, they're teaching on overload, ridiculous amounts of overload. And it's nice that they get a little bit of extra money to teach those 15 units every semester or more. But on the other hand, what does that do? I worry about their humanity, their work-life balance, their ability to be at Davis for the dissertation meetings, everything that happened there, because none of that ever happens here that I have ever seen, as well as serving the needs of, we have, I believe, 30 students in the Preliminary Administrative Services Credential Program who are primarily being taught by adjuncts. And we have 12 candidates this year in the CLEAR Administrative Services Credential being taught half-time by adjuncts. So I really would love it if we could have a true partnership with Davis and continue Candel, but in the way that it is now, it's not a partnership in my view. I worry about the faculty in my department, and I am in favor of discontinuing.
Senator Brannan.
Yes, thank you. It seems like one of the main arguments for discontinuance is a lack of resources, and that was the same argument given for discontinuing the direct entry Masters of Nursing program. And yet, in the case of the nursing program, it seems like their EPC was wanting to make a statement that we need more resources, we need to keep this valuable program alive, and so whether it gets discontinued or not, we should recommend that it not be discontinued. But yet in this case, a majority of EPC seems to be in favor of discontinuance. I don't quite see the difference. I think maybe the Senate could make a statement that it should not be discontinued, and then I'm quite confident it will be anyway. But what do we want to have as our statement? Do we want to acquiesce to the dwindling resources and just let everything go and shrink our Senate down to five people meeting in a closet? Or do we want to make a statement that the university needs to provide more resources and that we go down the stream?
Okay, so we have a few people on the speakers list, but Vice Chair Julie is opted to wait until after
Senator Milligan and Dean Ayala have a chance to respond to some of the things that will come up. So, Senator Milligan.
Thank you. I want to, in response to Senator Brannon's questions about the difference between the two EPC decisions, I would note that in the recommendation document for Candel that EPC generated, funding issues aren't mentioned in the 4 points noted in support of recommending the discontinuance. There's a recognition that, yes, perhaps discontinuing the program might bring a modest but unknown amount of resources back to SSU. It might free it up. There's a real recognition of the issue of faculty overload in managing the Candel program, but EPC's decision was not resource-driven in the same way that their decision in relation to the nursing program was.
Yeah, just to kind of clarify this situation. This is soft money that comes in. Okay, so what is that? What does that imply? It implies that I can't hire a tenure-track faculty person to using that money to do the teaching, and the implications of having my educational leadership faculty focused on Candel is that I have large numbers of adjuncts teaching within the other area, the preliminary, the principal's credential, and the second level of principal's credential. That's where I have all the adjuncts. Could I hire another educational faculty person to teach within those, provide leadership within those programs? I could, but if the cut of a budget occurred again unilaterally from UC Davis from 225 to 165, maybe another cut. And I don't have the Candel program to fill loads. I would have three faculty. I couldn't fill their loads. There wouldn't be enough classes within that program. And so I have other programs in my school that I need additional support for. So I'm not going to hire on in that domain because it would be risky. That's the resource issue.
Okay, so Vice Chair Ely?
I wanted to make a comment that speaks in some sense to discontinuances and the difficult decisions that we have to make. Because yes, we could vote against discontinuances and then let somebody else discontinue and then quite frankly complain that our view was not taken because of resources. But the reality is resources are a reality and we have to live within our set of resources. And we have to, even without the issue of resources, we have to make difficult decisions about what we want to do. We can't just have every program that we want. And you guys all know that. I'm not telling you anything new. And so I think one of the things we want to think about is that overall picture. I'm not saying yes or no for any given one, but I think we have to think carefully about what our responsibility is to make the difficult decisions, whether the difficult decision be to keep a program or to drop the program. That we can't have our cake and eat it too. And if we want to serve some students, we may not be able to serve the others because we can't serve everything. So having listened for the entire semester to us talking about workload, let's remember that when we make our decisions, all right? And think about that and think about these programs in the context of everything we're doing, not just the individual program. So I'm hoping that we can have sort of a balanced way of thinking about it.
And if anyone is contemplating a motion along the way and can start to draft your language, I would encourage you to do so. Dr. McHugh.
Two final points I failed to mention. One is that the MOU, which I think expires soon, May 22nd or something like that, provides, has a process in it to deal with disagreements, it empowers both sides and both parties. And throughout this process, it has been characterized that Davis has forced things onto us. And I think to a certain degree, that was a product of the large number of cuts happening to higher education in both systems since the Great Recession, and the MOU can be revisited annually or later than that, and has a process for both parties to express their disagreements. And the final point I would make is that budgets are about values, reflect our values, and are monitored by discretion. These are two key things we teach our students. They reflect values and discretion. And the values and discretions that we choose for discontinuance or for any other element of any other program reflect how we want to advance students beyond the master's, whether they go from EDEL or into a doctoral program. So thank you for your consideration.
Senator Crude.
I'm curious what the benefits to Sonoma State service area students are with the Kandel program as it currently is. If students have to go to UC Davis to take classes, apply to UC Davis to get into the program and pay UC Davis fees, what's the Sonoma State sort of student benefit in the program as it is now?
Does anyone want to respond to that?
I can respond. The benefit is, and I know that Katie Music actually brought this up at EPC. The students, and I'll talk about Maite Iturralde. She is the principal at El Verano School in Sonoma. She got her teaching credential with us. She got her principal's credential, and she has an excellent community-based school there. If you ever are interested in those kind of things, incredible field to that place. She also is a Kandel student. She hasn't finished yet. She's still working on that. What she talked about, because I talked to her about this, I wanted to talk about my argument, see what she had to do. She's a very smart person, and as I was talking to her, she the value for her was that there was this continuation with some of the faculty here and then some of the faculty over there at UC Davis. So we know that the classes are taught over there. They do their sign up there. They do their reg here, and then we come back and facilitate, you know, access to the library here and those kind of things. It's that personal connection that we would lose. But I would ask you to think about how many students we're talking about compared to this other larger group of students who I believe we could serve in a better way by having our focus and attention.
Okay, Senator Music.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify that when I went to EPC, I was representing myself and not in my position as staff senator. Thank you.
We've hit the end of the speakers list. Is there anyone else who would like to weigh in? Make this case pro or con? Senator Ray.
I just want to point out that we don't have to make a decision today. We still have one more Senate meeting.
Well, yeah, is there a motion to do anything? Is there a motion to make a recommendation? Is there a motion to table to a future meeting? Okay, so Senator Madavi.
How this is going to go. I move to recommend discontinuance of the Kandel policy program.
I'll second that.
Okay, so we have a motion, we have a second. Is there any discussion on that motion? Senator, Okay. So Senator Watt and then Brad.
I'd just like to request that if the motion goes forward that we have a paper ballot.
Okay, so we have a request for a paper ballot. We have those available. Senator Browning.
Yes, I want to speak against making a decision today. I think this is a very complicated issue. The documents are in the order of 90 pages long. I think another 2 weeks for people to seriously consider this would be helpful, and so I hope we vote no to make a decision today.
Okay. And so what we would need to do, if that were to be the case, is we would have to vote against this motion, and then have a new motion to table it to a specific date, i.e. the last Senate session, and just so that you know procedurally what would happen there. Any other discussion on this motion to recommend discontinuance?
I have a procedural question.
So you have a
procedural
sure.
question. So if we're voting on this motion, but we don't know if we're really voting on it, because we would vote no, but what if we want to vote no, but what if, and then what happens?
Okay.
I'm confused.
So just procedurally, the things that we could do here. we could have a vote on this motion to recommend for discontinuance and just be at that. We could have an amendment to this motion, in which case we might include a statement that we recommend against it with this statement block, right? And that could be in there. Or if we feel like we need further discussion, we could vote against this. If the majority vote against this, we're back to where we were before the motion happened. A motion could come forward, we could go then. And if people felt like we still want to have a motion to vote for discontinuance, that could happen again. This isn't your only chance to say you want discontinuance or you want continuance. Okay? Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. So, Senator Garvin?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes.
Point of order, we do not use majority, we use plurality.
Ah, yes. I am corrected. So, Senator Garvin?
That's me.
Is Garvin, Senator Garvin? No, you are on. Senator Creer, I'm sorry.
I was just going to speak out in favor of Jennifer's motion, or Senator Najavi's motion. We've had a month to look at the documents already. I think two additional weeks aren't going to, if you haven't read them, you're probably not going to read them for the next 2 weeks.
Any other discussion on the motion? Okay. I'm not seeing any. So do we have the paper ballots?
I sent Brian down.
Brian was fetching our pieces. It's been so long, I guess, since we've done this. In the meantime, is there any other discussion on this? Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to suspend this business item. We'll do reports until Brian gets back with the blank ballots. And then, assuming that happens within the next 9 minutes, then we're fine. If not, we might need to move to extend so that we can do that election. With that said, we move to the standing chairs and... EPC, is there anything else to report? EPC all the time.
Yes, absolutely. EPC met this morning, and at our meeting this morning, we approved a range of information and consent items all related to individual course approvals. I won't go down that laundry list for you. We had two new business items on the agenda. First, a proposal to revise the biochemistry BS, and the first reading was waived on that, and it was approved unanimously. It's a relatively minor set of changes that are in response to the biology changes from their program that you saw earlier this semester. The second new business item was a proposal for a new academic credit certificate. This is the French language for wine business certificate, and also to make sure that we dealt with this efficiently. The first reading was waived. The proposal was received positively in a unanimous fashion. And so you will be seeing that coming forward to you as well. Also, we spent time discussing EPC's response to the Senate committee reorganization proposal. And so we have, you'll be seeing some comments with regard to that forthcoming.
Great. Any questions for EPC?
Do you sleep?
Yeah.
Okay. FSAC, Faculty Standards and Affairs. Senator Wickes.
Sure. Today we had three issues that we dealt with. One was a business item. We discussed the report from the university, the annual report from the university RTP committee. Maureen Buckley, the chair of that committee, came to report about their activities this year. A lot of that report had to do with the RTP process, as you might imagine. Hold that thought. Second point was that we heard a report from AVP from Faculty Affairs, Melinda Bernard, on the Moodle pilot project, which dealt with the electronic submission of RTP files this past round. And we talked about how well that worked, also in response to previous report from the RTP chair, Marie Buckley. And we provided AVP Bernard with a number of recommendations on how to continue that project next year. And the third item that we had was a discussion item, which was to outline the major areas for the RTP policy revision for next year, following up on, go back up to items 1 and 2 above. And therefore, we laid out some broad pathways by which we feel that we can continue continue that process, and our hope is to get the draft of that done by December so that it can be worked on at the Faculty Governance and Senate for next spring.
Okay, any questions for FSAC? Senator Marmon?
I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask this, Senator Witkus, but I'm curious, do you know how many departments have their own RTP standards and how many departments or how many departments don't have their own and just defer to the university standards?
Yeah, you can easily find that out by going to the Academic Affairs website or to click on the RTP area for that. And down below that, down below the policy and the forms, there's a whole listing of the posted criteria for the different schools. It's getting more and more. I think most schools now have criteria that would match it. And it's a good idea if one's thinking about developing their own criteria, especially go look at other criteria within your own school to get good ideas.
Okay, so we're going to start distributing the ballots.
Point of confusion.
As Senator Watt.
Just in response to Senator Morimoto's question, the last time I checked, there were 7 departments that don't have their own criteria.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. So,
point of information, order, confusion, before we vote, please.
I'm sorry, say so that.
I don't know what point I'm trying to make. I have a point. I want to make sure we're clear on what we're voting. The resolution, the motion on the floor is a yes vote means we recommend discontinuance, and a no vote means we recommend not to discontinue.
Point of order.
So the motion, as I understood it, was to recommend discontinuance.
Yes.
So in this case, we have that countercognitive pattern of a vote yes is in favor of a recommendation of discontinuance. Yes means the program goes away. No means... Not this time. Right? Not at this point.
No means
we're not making that recommendation.
Right. All we can do is recommend.
Right.
No.
So if you vote yes, you are voting yes to recommend discontinuance. If you vote no, you're saying that's not the recommendation that we're doing now. Right? It isn't saying I am voting for a recommendation of yes. That wasn't the motion. The motion is will we discontinue? Okay, the recommendation for discontinuance. So,
Yael? So, EPC is recommending discontinuance. A vote of yes means support discontinuance.
Yes.
So that supports
right. EPC. And as the motion stands now, it is not qualified with any kind of statement, okay, which could either be in this move or it could be if somebody wanted to amend the motion, which you can do one level. If not, we could have a motion right after if we wanted to add a statement. So any further discussion on the motion?
Again, sorry. A no vote does not mean we continue discussing it.
No.
Well, actually, a no vote says we're back to prior to the motion,
right.
Which means we have to move the table to a time or do something. It's
I
not done when we vote no. Okay. So,
I'm a special ed kid. What do you want?
No, I understand. It's Robert's rules. I'm just trying to be clear and loud so people can hear. Senator Nelson.
I said point of order, but maybe this is more a question. If you vote, if the Senate votes not to recommend discontinuance, if that's our position, why do we need to talk about it more?
Right.
Well, we can vote to not discontinue.
Right. That's very much.
No, the motion on the floor is to make a recommendation for discontinuance. If we say yes, we're making that recommendation. If we say no, we're not making that recommendation. That doesn't mean we're recommending that it be continued. That would be a separate
motion
that would then have to be voted on. It just means this motion fails, period. And then we're back to discussing the item, doing some, we're back to square one.
And 2 minutes left. So then we would have a motion to extend or not. Okay, so please, I won't get one of these unless it's a tie.
I'm sorry. That was my fault.
It's okay. So please mark your ballots.
Just yes or no, right?
Yes, just yes or no. And then when you're done, just raise it. We'll have people running around touching.
Please.
So while the ballots are being collected, I would like to recognize immediate past chairperson.
I move to extend the current Senate meeting by 10 minutes.
Second.
Any discussion on that? All those in favor of extending by 10 minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay. Okay, I heard a lot more ayes than nays, so we will extend for 10 minutes. We have to count.
Any masks missing?
Okay, so all ballots are in? Okay. Let's see. So while we're waiting for the counts, does Student Affairs have anything to report?
I'm over here, but I unfortunately have to leave.
You have to leave. Yeah. Okay.
But I will email that to you.
Okay, then I can go out. Senator Musick.
I had a question for FSAC in the discussion.
Sure.
I just wanted to find out what the result was or if the decision has been made regarding the issue of staff participation in chair selection.
Thank you. Yes, FSAC has made a recommendation that has been forwarded to the executive committee.
Can you talk louder?
Yes, a recommendation has been made, and that recommendation has been forwarded to the executive committee.
Thank you.
Recommending what? Sorry.
A recommendation has been made, and that recommendation has been forwarded to the executive committee.
About staff being involved in the chair selection process.
So let's turn to CSA chapter president. Is she here? Not here. Okay. Staff Representative Musick, anything to report?
I do not have anything.
Nothing to report. Anything else? We're just waiting on the ballot. So you had a question for?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if this is for the provost and the president, but so this is my 16th year here. I was hoping to get my 15-year service award, but I didn't hear anything about the award ceremony, so I contacted Faculty Affairs. I was told that it's not going to happen this year. It's going to happen next fall. I just wondered, is that a new thing?
I have not heard anything about that.
I was surprised. I wasn't sure if it's just because
they are always talking about it.
I thought maybe they just forgot to do it this year until I contacted them. I hear I get a little box that I can put my ashes in.
Well, one thing that may be a factor in the change in the calendar, there was a decision sometime back that they would be changing at which point of the year it counted, because some people who had come in August had finished in July weren't getting recognized as having a year's service until the next August. So it may be part of that reset, because I didn't see that ceremony change in time, so it's possible that I remember there was a decision of moving to have years of service be, have you done your service in that academic year. Okay, so we have the results, and we have 18 in favor of discontinuance, and we have, recommending discontinuance, and we have 16 recommending, voting against a recommendation for discontinuance. So at this point, we do have another 8 minutes on our extension. We may want to consider, is there any language that we want to attach to that recommendation to help the president and the chancellor form an opinion? I would, of course, send this forward indicating that it was a split and nearly evenly split decision by the Senate. But it would be nice to have something a little bit more qualitative than simply quantitative. So, is there anything anybody would suggest as potential text in there? Because otherwise, I'm drafting a recommendation based on what I heard. That was a plea. It obviously fell upon deaf ears.
Okay.
All right, so we actually got through all the reports, surprise, surprise. I have one item for the good of the order that I would like to add, and so that is, you've recently received in your mailboxes in all your departments this invitation for the honor of your presence at the graduation ceremonies. It is normally a day of work. If you have a professional conflict, it's understood why you might not be here. But you are actually invited to both. There is a lunch midday that is provided. If you send an RSVP, the email address for Laurel is on here, then we can make sure there's a meal for you at lunchtime. And also, if you can let us know, you're not making it to both, but you're making it to one, let us know, and that way we can make sure we have sufficient seats and bottles for those who would be coming. I do encourage you to come, especially to your own schools, but it's also really great to come to both. You've had students from all the schools in your classes, most of us, and it's one of the few chances that some of those students can introduce you to the family. They've often been supporting you. The number of times I've heard students say really meaningful, powerful things in the presence of their family, stuff that we often don't hear on the settings or when they're grumbling about their grades, but at the end of the day or at the end of their career here, they often will look back with wiser eyes and have that appreciation. So I encourage you to come. Any other items for the good of the order? Christian.
Yes, so I'm a member of the Sonoma State's history, the History Journal on campus, and we are having a release of the History Journal, which is comprised of original pieces of work from Sonoma State students across all disciplines, and we're releasing that in the Sue Jameson Room May 12th at 4 p.m. So if you would like to come and see original research done by students on campus, you're more than welcome to come, and hors d'oeuvres will be there.
Okay. Any other items? You also will notice that there's a handout here at every other seat. This was brought to us to circulate amongst the faculty. It's the Uniting for Success newsletter. And with that, I'm not seeing any other items, so we're adjourned. Only 6 minutes open.
professional. But I wanted to.
It was.
I know.
I don't know.
You should run next time.
No, no, no.